Hello, and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a feature article by Bembe et al. Extracorporeal membrane oxygenation characteristics and outcomes in children and adolescents with COVID-19 or multisystem inflammatory syndrome admitted to U.S. ICUs. Objectives. Extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, has been used successfully to support adults with severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 or SARS-CoV-2 related cardiac or respiratory failure refractory to conventional therapies. Comprehensive reports of children and adolescents with SARS-CoV-2 related ECMO support for conditions, including multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, or MISC, and acute COVID-19, are needed. Design. Case series of patients from the Overcoming COVID-19 Public Health Surveillance Registry. Setting: 63 hospitals in 32 U.S. states reporting to the registry between March 15, 2020 and December 31, 2021. Patients included patients less than 21 years old admitted to the ICU meeting Centers for Disease Control criteria for MISC or acute COVID-19. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The final cohort included 2,733 patients with MISC or acute COVID-19. 1,530 had MISC with 37 or 2.4% requiring ECMO, and 1,203 had acute COVID-19 with 71 or 5.9% requiring ECMO. ECMO patients in both groups were older than those without ECMO support. The median age in the MISC group was 15.4 versus 9.9 years, and the median age in the acute COVID-19 group was 15.3 years versus 13.6 years. The body mass index percentile was similar in the MISC ECMO versus no ECMO groups, 89.9 versus 85.8 with a p-value equal to 0.22, but higher in the COVID-19 ECMO versus no ECMO groups, 98.3 versus 96.5, with a p-value equal to 0.03. Patients on ECMO with MISC versus COVID-19 were supported more often with veno-arterial ECMO, 92 versus 41%, for primary cardiac indications, 87 versus 23%, had ECMO initiated earlier, median 1 versus 5 days from hospitalization, shorter ECMO courses, median 3.9 versus 14 days, shorter hospital length of stay, median 20 days versus 52 days, lower in-hospital mortality, 27% versus 37%, and less major morbidity at discharge in survivors. Major morbidity at discharge in survivors in patients on ECMO with MISC versus COVID-19 was defined as the following: new tracheostomy, 0 versus 11%, oxygen or mechanical ventilation need, 0 versus 20%, or neurologic deficit, 8% versus 15%. Most patients with MISC requiring ECMO support, 87%, were admitted during the pre-Delta variant B.1.617.2 period, while most patients with acute COVID-19 requiring ECMO support, 70%, were admitted during the Delta variant period. Conclusions. ECMO support for SARS-CoV-2 related critical illness was uncommon, but type, initiation, and duration of ECMO use in MISC and acute COVID-19 were markedly different. Like pre-pandemic pediatric ECMO cohorts, most patients survived to hospital discharge. Abstract 2 is a feature review article by Ista et al. Factors associated with delirium in children, a systematic review and meta-analysis. Objectives. Pediatric delirium is a neuropsychiatric syndrome caused by a complex interplay between predisposing factors, for example, age and cognitive impairment, acute illness, and environmental triggers. Pediatric delirium is associated with substantial morbidity and mortality. The objective of this study is to systematically review and evaluate factors associated with pediatric delirium in hospitalized pediatric patients. Data sources: a systematic search of PubMed, Embase, Ovid Medline, Web of Science, Cochrane, CINAHL, and Google Scholar databases was conducted for relevant studies from 1990 to 2022. Study selection. We included studies that compared pediatric patients with and without delirium. Reviews, editorials, Congress abstracts, or studies that did not report factors for pediatric delirium were excluded. No restrictions were imposed on language. Title and abstract were independently screened by two reviewers. Individual characteristics, study design, and outcomes were independently extracted. Data synthesis. Categorical dichotomous data were summarized across groups using Mantel-Haenszel odds ratios with 95% confidence intervals. Either fixed effect or random effects models were used as indicated by the results of a heterogeneity test. Of 1,846 abstracts, 24 studies were included. We identified 54 factors studied in univariate analyses, and 27 of these were associated with pediatric delirium in multivariable analyses. In pooled analyses, greater odds of pediatric delirium were associated with developmental delay, need for mechanical ventilation, use of physical restraints, and receipt of either benzodiazepines, opiates, steroids, or vasoactive medication. The odds ratio for developmental delay was 3.98 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.54 to 10.26. The odds ratio for mechanical ventilation was 6.02 with a 95% confidence interval of 4.43 to 8.19. The odds ratio for physical restraints was 4.67 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.82 to 11.96. The odds ratio of benzodiazepines was 4.1 with a 95% confidence interval of 2.48 to 6.8. Odds ratio for opiates was 2.88 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.89 to 4.37. Odds ratio for steroids was 2.02 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.47 to 2.77. And odds ratio for vasoactive medication was 3.68 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.17 to 11.6. Conclusions. In this meta-analysis, we identified seven factors associated with greater odds of developing delirium during pediatric critical illness. Abstract 3 is a clinical investigation by Jones et al. Improving Daily Patient Goal Setting and Team Communication, the Liberate Glass Door Project. Objectives: to develop and implement a tool to improve daily patient goal setting, team collaboration, and communication. Design: Quality Improvement Implementation Project. Setting: tertiary level PICU. Patients: inpatient children less than 18 years old requiring ICU level care. Intervention: a glass door daily goals communication tool located in the door front of each patient room. Measurements and main results: we use Pronovost's 4E's model to implement the glass door. Primary outcomes were uptake of goal setting, healthcare team discussion rate around goals, rounding efficiency, acceptability, and sustainability of the glass door. The total implementation duration from engagement to evaluation of sustainability was 24 months. Goal setting increased significantly from 22.9% to 90.7% patient days using the glass door compared to a paper-based daily goals checklist with a p-value less than 0.01. 1 year post-implementation, the uptake was sustained at 93.1% with a p-value equal to 0.04. Rounding time decreased from a median of 11.7 minutes with a 95% confidence interval 10.9 to 12.4 minutes to 7.5 minutes with a 95% confidence interval 6.9 to 7.9 minutes per patient post-implementation with a p-value less than 0.01. Goal discussions on ward rounds increased overall from 40.1% to 58.5% with a p-value less than 0.01. 91% of team members perceived that the glass door improves communication for patient care, and 80% preferred the glass door to the daily goals checklist for communicating patient goals with other team members. 66% of family members found the glass door helpful in understanding the daily plan, and 83% found it helpful in ensuring thorough discussion among the PICU team. Conclusions. The glass door is a highly visible tool that can improve patient goal setting and collaborative team discussion with good uptake and acceptability among healthcare team members and patient families. Abstract 4 is a cardiac intensive care article by Marino et al. Long-term quality of life in congenital heart disease surgical survivors, multicenter retrospective study of surgical and ICU explanatory factors. Objectives: greater congenital heart disease, or CHD, complexity is associated with lower health-related quality of life. There are no data on the association between surgical and ICU factors and health-related quality of life in CHD survivors. This study assesses the association between surgical and ICU factors and health-related quality of life in child and adolescent CHD survivors. Design. This was a corollary study of the Pediatric Cardiac Quality of Life Inventory, or PCQLI, testing study. Setting, 8 pediatric hospitals participating in the PCQLI study. Patients. Patients in the study had the Fontan procedure, surgery for tetralogy of Fallot, and transposition of the great arteries. Measurements and main results. Surgical and ICU explanatory variables were collected by reviewing the medical records. Primary outcome variables, including PCQLI total patient and parent scores and covariates, were obtained from the data registry. General linear modeling was used to create the multivariable models. There were 572 patients included. Mean age was 11.7 years and a standard deviation plus or minus 2.9 years. CHD included 45% Fontan, 55% tetralogy of Fallot or transposition of the great arteries. The mean number of cardiac surgeries was 2 with a range of 1 to 9, and mean number of ICU admissions was 3 with a range of 1 to 9. In multivariable models, lowest body temperature on cardiopulmonary bypass was negatively associated with patient total score, with a p-value less than 0.05. The total number of cardiopulmonary bypass runs was negatively associated with parent-reported PCQLI total score, with a p-value less than 0.02. Cumulative days on an inotropic or vasoactive drug in the ICU was negatively associated with all patient and parent reported PCQLI scores with a p-value less than 0.04. Neurological deficit at discharge was negatively associated with parent reported PCQLI total score with a p-value less than 0.02. The variance explained by these factors range from 24% to 29%. Conclusions. Surgical and/or ICU factors, demographic, and medical care utilization variables explain a low to moderate amount of variation in health-related quality of life. Research is needed to determine whether modification of these surgical and ICU factors improves health-related quality of life and to identify other factors that contribute to unexplained variability. Abstract 5 is a neurocritical care article by Sveen et al. Adverse events during apnea testing for the determination of death by neurologic criteria, a single-center retrospective pediatric cohort. Objectives: to report the prevalence of adverse events in children undergoing apnea testing as part of the determination of death by neurologic criteria. Design: single-center retrospective study. Setting: academic children's hospital that is a level 1 trauma center. Patients: all children who underwent apnea testing to determine death by neurologic criteria from July 2013 to June 2020. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We abstracted the medical history, blood gases, ventilator settings, blood pressures, vasoactive infusions, intracranial pressures, chest radiographs, and echocardiograms for all apnea tests as well as any ancillary test. Adverse events were defined as hypotension, hypoxia, pneumothorax, arrhythmia, intracranial hypertension, and cardiac arrest. 58 patients had 105 apnea tests. Adverse events occurred in 21 of 105 apnea tests, or 20%, the most common being hypotension in 15 of 105, or 14%, and hypoxia in 4 of 105, or 4%. 5 of 21 apnea tests, or 24%, with adverse events were terminated prematurely. 3 for hypoxia, 1 for hypotension, and 1 for both hypoxia and hypotension, but the patients did not require persistent escalation in care. In the other 16 of 21 apnea tests, or 76% with adverse events, clinical changes were transient and managed by titrating vasoactive infusions or completing the apnea test. Conclusions. In our center, 20% of all apnea tests were associated with adverse events. Only 5% of all apnea tests required premature termination, and the remaining 15% were completed and the adverse events resolved with medical care. Abstract 6 is a review article by Watanabe et al. Extracorporeal membrane oxygenation in children with COVID-19, a systematic review and meta-analysis. Objectives: the indication, complications, and outcomes of extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, in children with COVID-19-related illnesses remains unelucidated. Our study aimed to investigate the characteristics and outcomes of ECMO in children with COVID-19-related illnesses. Data sources: we searched PubMed and Embase databases in March 2022. Study selection: We retrieved all studies involving children less than or equal to 18 years old with COVID-19-related illnesses who received ECMO. Data extraction. Two authors independently extracted data and assessed the risk of bias. Mortality, successful weaning rate, and complications while on ECMO were synthesized by a one-group meta-analysis using a random effect model. Meta-regression was performed to explore the risk factors for mortality. Data synthesis. We included 18 observational studies, 4 case series, and 22 case reports involving 110 children with COVID-19-related illnesses receiving ECMO. The median age was 8 years, with a range of 10 days to 18 years, and the median body mass index was 21.4 kilograms per meter squared, with a range of 12.3 to 56 kilograms per meter squared. The most common comorbidities were obesity in 11%, or 7 of 63, and congenital heart disease in 11%, or 7 of 63, whereas 48%, or 30 of 63, were previously healthy. The most common indications for ECMO were multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children in 52%, or 47 of 90, and severe acute respiratory distress syndrome in 40%, or 36 of 90. 71%, or 56 of 79, received veno-arterial ECMO. The median ECMO run time was 6 days, with a range of 3 to 51 days for veno-arterial ECMO, and 11 days, with a range of 3 to 71 days for veno-venous ECMO. The mortality rate was 26.6%, with a 95% confidence interval of 15.9 to 40.9, and the successful weaning rate was 77%, with a 95% confidence interval of 55.4 to 90.1. Complications were seen in 37%, with a 95% confidence interval of 23.1 to 53.5 while on ECMO, including stroke, acute kidney injury, pulmonary edema, and thromboembolism. Corticosteroids and IV immunoglobulin therapies were associated with lower mortality. Conclusions. The mortality of children on ECMO for COVID-19 was relatively low. This invasive treatment can be considered as a treatment option for critically ill children with COVID-19. Abstract 7 is an online clinical investigation by Akande et al. Child Opportunity Index in Emergent PICU Readmissions, a retrospective cross-sectional study of 43 U.S. hospitals. Objectives: to examine the association between a validated composite measure of neighborhood factors, the Child Opportunity Index, or COI, and emergent PICU readmission during the year following discharge for survivors of pediatric critical illness. Design: retrospective cross-sectional study. Setting: 43 U.S. Children's Hospitals contributing to the Pediatric Health Information System Administrative Dataset. Patients: children less than 18 years old with at least one emergent PICU admission in 2018 to 2019 who survived an index admission. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of 78,839 patients, 26% resided in very low COI neighborhoods, 21% in low COI, 19% in moderate COI, 17% in high COI, and 17% in very high COI neighborhoods, and 12.6% had an emergent PICU readmission within 1 year. After adjusting for patient-level demographic and clinical factors, residents in neighborhoods with moderate, low, and very low COI was associated with increased odds of emergent 1 year PICU readmission relative to patients in very high COI neighborhoods. Lower COI levels were associated with readmission in diabetic ketoacidosis and asthma. We failed to find an association between COI and emergent PICU readmission in patients with an index PICU admission diagnosis of respiratory conditions, sepsis, or trauma. Conclusions: children living in neighborhoods with lower child opportunity had an increased risk of emergent one-year readmission to the PICU, particularly children with chronic conditions such as asthma and diabetes. Assessing the neighborhood context to which children return following critical illness may inform community-level initiatives to foster recovery and reduce the risk of adverse outcomes. Abstract 8 is an online clinical investigation by Danzer et al. Extracorporeal membrane oxygenation for neonates with congenital diaphragmatic hernia, prevalence of seizures and outcomes. Objectives: we aim to determine the prevalence of electrographic seizures and associated odds of adverse outcomes of electrographic seizures in neonates with congenital diaphragmatic hernia, or CDH, receiving extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO. Design: retrospective descriptive case series. Setting: neonatal ICU or NICU in a quaternary care institution. Patients: All neonates with CDH receiving ECMO undergoing continuous electroencephalographic monitoring, or CEEG, and follow-up between January 2012 and December 2019. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. All eligible neonates with CDH receiving ECMO underwent CEEG with an N equal to 75. Electrographic seizures occurred in 14 of 75, or 19%. They were exclusively electrographic only in 9 of 14, both electrographic only and electroclinical in 3 of 14, and electroclinical only in 2 of 14. Two neonates developed status epilepticus. We identified an association between presence of seizures rather than not and longer duration of initial session of CEEG monitoring, 55.7 hours with an interquartile range of 48.2 to 87.3 hours versus 48 hours with an interquartile range of 43 to 48.3 hours with a p-value equal to 0.001. We also found an association between presence of seizures rather than not and greater odds of use of a second CEEG monitoring in 12 of 14 versus 21 of 61 with an odds ratio of 11.43 and a 95% confidence interval of 2.34 to 55.9 with a p-value equal to 0.0026. Most neonates with seizures in 10 of 14 experienced their onset of seizures more than 96 hours after the start of ECMO. Overall, the presence of electrographic seizures compared with not was associated with lower odds of survival to NICU discharge in 4 of 14 versus 49 of 61 with an odds ratio of 0.1 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.03 to 0.37 with a p-value equal to 0.0006. Also, the presence of seizures rather than not was associated with greater odds of a composite of death and all abnormal outcomes on follow-up in 13 of 14 versus 26 of 61 with an odds ratio of 17.5 and a 95% confidence interval of 2.15 to 142.39 and a p-value equal to 0.0074. Conclusions. Nearly 1 in 5 neonates with CDH receiving ECMO developed seizures during the ECMO course. Seizures were predominantly electrographic only, and when present, were associated with great odds of adverse outcomes. The current study provides evidence to support standardized CEEG in this population. Abstract 9 is an online clinical investigation by Gendler et al. Pre-hospital tranexamic acid administration in pediatric trauma patients, a propensity-matched analysis of the Israeli Defense Forces Registry. Objectives. Tranexamic acid or TXA administration confers a survival benefit in bleeding trauma patients. However, data regarding its use in pediatric patients are limited. This study evaluates the pre-hospital treatment with TXA in pediatric trauma patients treated by the Israeli Defense Forces Medical Corps. Design. Retrospective cohort study using the Israeli Defense Forces Registry from 2011 to 2021. Patients included pediatric trauma patients less than 18 years old. We excluded patients pronounced dead at the scene. There were no interventions. Setting. All cases of pediatric trauma in the registry were assessed for treatment with TXA. Propensity score matching was used to assess the association between pre-hospital TXA administration and mortality. Measurements and main results. Overall, 911 pediatric trauma patients were treated with TXA by the Israeli Defense Forces Medical Corps teams. The median age was 10 years old with an interquartile range of 5 to 15 years, and 72.8% were male. 70 patients, or 7.6%, received TXA, with 52 of 70, or 74%, receiving a 1,000 mg dose with a range of 200 to 1,000 mg. There were no pre-hospital adverse events associated with the use of TXA, with the upper limit of 95% confidence interval for 0 of 70 being 4.3%. Compared with pediatric patients who did not receive TXA, patients receiving TXA were more likely to suffer from shock, 40% versus 10.7%, and a p-value less than 0.001, sustain more penetrating injuries, 72.9% versus 31.7% with a p-value less than 0.001, be treated with plasma or crystalloids, 62.9% versus 11.4% with a p-value less than 0.001, and undergo more life-saving interventions, 24.3% versus 6.2% with a p-value less than 0.001. The propensity score matching failed to identify an association between TXA and lesser odds of mortality, although a lack of effect or even adverse effect could not be excluded. Non-TXA 7.1% versus TXA 4.3%, odds ratio equal to 0.584, and a 95% confidence interval 0.084 to 3.143, with a p-value equal to 0.718. Conclusions. Although pre-hospital TXA administration in the pediatric population is feasible with adverse event rate under 5%, more research is needed to determine the appropriate approach to pediatric hemostatic resuscitation and the role of TXA in this population. Abstract 10 is an online clinical investigation by Obera et al. Association of pre-hospital physician presence during pediatric out-of-hospital cardiac arrest with neurologic outcomes. Objectives. To examine the association of pre-hospital physician presence with neurologic outcomes of pediatric patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Design, retrospective cohort study. Setting, data from the Japanese Association for Acute Medicine Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest Registry. There were no interventions. Patients, pediatric patients aged 17 years old or younger registered in the database between June 2014 and December 2019. Measurements and main results. We used logistic regression models with stabilized inverse probability of treatment weighting to estimate the associated treatment effect of a pre-hospital physician with 1 month neurologically intact survival. Secondary outcomes included in-hospital return of spontaneous circulation and 1 month survival after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. A total of 1,187 patients were included, 276 in the physician presence group, and 911 in the physician absence group, with a median age of 3 years old and an interquartile range of 0 to 14 years old, with 723 or 61% males. Comparison of the physician presence group versus the physician absence group showed 1 month favorable neurologic outcomes in the physician presence group with 8.3% or 23 of 276 versus 3.6% in the physician absence group or 33 of 911. Physician presence was associated with greater odds of 1 month neurologically intact survival after stabilized inverse probability of treatment weighting adjustment, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.98 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 3.66. We also found an association in the secondary outcome between physician presence opposed to absence and in-hospital return of spontaneous circulation, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.48 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 2.04. However, we failed to identify an association with 1 month survival, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.49 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.97 to 2.88. Conclusions. Among pediatric patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, pre-hospital physician presence compared with absence was associated with almost twofold greater odds of 1 month favorable neurologic outcomes. Abstract 11 is an online brief report by Warren et al. Effects of unit census and patient acuity levels on discussions during patient rounds. Objectives. PICU teams adapt the duration of patient rounding discussions to accommodate varying contextual factors such as unit census and patient acuity. Although studies establish that shorter discussions can lead to the omission of critical patient information, little is known about how teams adapt their rounding discussions about essential patient topics, for example, introduction and history, acute clinical status, and care plans in response to changing contexts. To fill this gap, we examined how census and patient acuity impact time spent discussing essential topics during individual patient encounters. Design, observational study. Setting, PICU at a university-affiliated children's hospital in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Subjects, interprofessional morning rounding teams. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We observed 165 individual patient encounters during morning rounds over 10 weeks. Regardless of census or patient acuity, the duration of patient introduction and history did not change. When census was high versus low, acute clinical status discussions significantly decreased for both low acuity patients and high acuity patients. For low acuity patients, it was 50 seconds with a high census and 1 minute 39 seconds with a low census, and a negative 49.5% change. And with high acuity patients, it was 1 minute 10 seconds with a high census and 2 minutes 2 seconds with a low census, and a negative 42.6% change. Durations of care plan discussions significantly reduced as a function of census for low but not high acuity patients, with 1 minute 19 seconds with a high census and 2 minutes 52 seconds with a low census, and a negative 54.7% change. Conclusions. Under high census and patient acuity levels, rounding teams disproportionately shorten time spent discussing essential patient topics. Of note, while teams preserve time to plan the care for acute patients, they cut care plan discussions of low acuity patients. This study provides needed detail regarding how rounding teams adapt their discussions of essential topics and establishes a foundation for consideration of varying contextual factors in the design of rounding guidelines. As ICUs are challenged with increasing census and patient acuity levels, it is critical that we turn our attention to these contextual aspects and understand how these adaptations impact clinical outcomes to address them. Abstract 12 is an online brief report by Dean et al., Protecting Sleep Hygiene in the PICU, a Quality Improvement Project. Objectives: to increase the number of nights without sleep interruptions for routine tasks in recovering PICU patients. Design: Prospective Quality Improvement Project. Setting: Single Center Freestanding Tertiary Children's Hospital. Patients: patients admitted to the PICU for greater than 72 hours and eligible for early mobilization. Interventions: a multidisciplinary sleep hygiene team was created to improve sleep hygiene in critically ill patients eligible for early mobilization. This team rewrote local nursing policies to avoid routine tasks between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. The team provided periodic control chart updates to staff detailing progress made protecting sleep. Discussions of sleep hygiene were added to the daily goal sheet, and a sleep hygiene order set was created. Finally, the PICU quality dashboard was modified to show whether a sleep hygiene order set was initiated in eligible patients. Measurements and main results. Routine tasks were defined as daily chest radiographs, baths, routine tracheostomy care, central line dressing changes, twice daily medications, weights, and Foley care. After a year of data collection, avoidance of routine pupillary examinations was added to the sleep protection criteria. Baseline data was collected for 2 months prior to the creation of the sleep hygiene team. Screening of eligible patients occurred 1 week each month. The data were analyzed using control charts. Baseline data demonstrated 32% of PICU patients without sleep interruptions. The center line increased to 58% after the initial interventions, but dropped to 33% after inclusion of pupillary checks. Following the introduction of the daily goal sheet, sleep hygiene order set, and tracking on the quality board, 49% of patients went without interruptions. Conclusions: the initiation of a sleep hygiene team, along with retiming routine tasks, daily discussion on rounds with the daily goal sheet, introduction of a sleep hygiene order set, and transparent tracking improved the percentage of patients with protected sleep. The PCCM narrative this month is entitled Line in the Sand by Claire Crawford. The top of his dark little head peeps out of a pile of light flannel blankets in the NICU while his healthy brother grows at home. Gauzy tape covers most of his barely visible face to hold the tube. Without it, there would be no breath to sustain his underdeveloped lungs. I'm reminded of a bird fallen from its nest far too early. Each feature is wrinkled and translucent, bizarrely exposing the delicate organs beneath. The extra tape added just below his nose ensures his cleft lip does not let precious little air escape. His mother speaks, and I finally remember she exists, that there is a mother here who is not me, that there is a baby here who is not mine. I ask her to repeat her question and gape at her as I try to understand any words beyond funeral. I try my best to numb and silence whatever it is that threatens to explode from my very being before I can escape the dark, quiet abyss of this place. I quickly retreat to a bathroom stall that is all too bright in contrast. Collecting myself with a deep breath, I allow myself to wonder, who did I see in that room? It must have been my twin that I saw, a sister with a cleft lip like the one I was born with. I never knew her, yet we shared blood, sustenance, and prized real estate in our mother's womb. For a single heart-stopping second, 30 years later, I feel I am looking at her, a cleft lip left wide open like mine, mirroring the person who should have been right by my side this whole time. Then it seemed that I was looking at my very own child instead of my twin, my little sweet pea. This boy, like mine, has a fatal chromosomal condition. What if my son, conceived in April and dead by July, had survived long enough to be born a dangerously premature infant? would he have been lucky or unlucky to make it to the NICU? I was looking at my own baby, who was not destined to survive in this world, but who we created with all the love in our hearts just the same. Or did I see my own ghost in his mother, the part of me that would have been, the part of me that I will never get back? I could have been this mother with puffy red eyes straining to stay open from crying too much and too long. I am jealous that I don't have my baby. I am relieved that I don't have to make the medical decisions that she does. And I am more heartbroken for the two of us mothers than words could express. Although filled with trepidation, I want to do my best for them as their assigned social worker. I take my place at a family meeting alongside the palliative care and NICU teams. As I listen to her story, it feels beautiful and profound and cruel that she uses all the words I said just months ago. I just want him to know we love him. How can I experience the joy of my other child when I know this one is not here anymore? How do I look at his face and not think of the one I lost? My social work professors evangelized the protective and immovable nature of boundaries. We learned of their ability to create healthy emotional distance for the sake of ourselves and our clients. In this case, there is no professional me and personal me. I am peering into a waterfall, a veil of reflective water I could reach through if I allow myself to get pummeled by the deluge in the process. My mouth says the things I should say as a professional. You have been so very thoughtful about your child. Your other son will never know him, but you will all carry on his legacy. We will make his final moments as peaceful as possible. In my head, I hear a parallel track. Why did this happen? When I get pregnant with another baby, how do I find joy again? How do we keep existing? You look so brave. Can you tell me how? She thanks us for the support and for being there for her, but I am not really there for her. I am there with her. In the natural world, boundaries mark places of beauty. The boundaries of the earth mark a terrain's limit, its inability to continue. The cave restricts the light, protecting the damp darkness within. The rise of the sand marks the end of the vast expanse of the sea. The intersection of a beginning and end indicates something new, and in that newness, an exquisiteness that words fail to capture. If we let them, our boundaries may show us more about who we are and where our pain lies. The reflective waterfall separating me from this mother showed me, through her, just how much I love my baby, my twin, and even myself. If she can remain standing and ready to face a future without her son, can I do the same? The boundary between us marks a limitation. We cannot articulate the thoughts that flood our minds when we relate to someone whose shoes we did not wish fit us, and yet we may find our own potential to become the place where wonder grows. Today, I cautiously extended my toe to test the water's temperature and instead submerged my whole foot before retreating. Did I recoil too quickly, seeking comfort before allowing myself to fully explore the source of my sadness? Or am I wisely protecting myself from being drenched by grief? For now, my heart requires time for examination and discovery. I cautiously draw a long and wobbly line in the sand. Will it stay? Or one day, as the tide rises and the wind blows, will the grains of sand cover one another until the line is too faint to see? This concludes the abstracts for the May 2023 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.